Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. On December 15, 1791, Congress passed the 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution that became the Bill of Rights. The first on that list enshrines a basic tenet of freedom, loosely interpreted the freedom of speech. That speech could be religion, the press, physically assembling or associating as a group, and much more. The interpretation of the First Amendment, drafted by the fourth president, James Madison, has changed and widened over the years. It's become a linchpin for many protections, as well as an excuse for expanding the powers of the powerful. Now, one of the U.S.'s most important constitutional lawyers, Bert Newborn, takes apart the 45 words that form the First Amendment in an entire book. His book is called Madison's Music on Reading the First Amendment. Bert Newborn is the Inez Milholland Professor of Civil Liberties and the founding legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University's Law School. He's also a contributor to The Nation, and he now joins me. Welcome to Uprising, Bert.
Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. You know, your book is about the First Amendment and the surrounding issues, but it's entitled Madison's Music, not Madison's Writings. Why is it music? Why do you refer to Madison as a great political poet?
Well, because my thesis is that the Bill of Rights, especially the First Amendment, tells a story, that the structure of the text, if we would only look at it, instead of just talking about the First Amendment as though it were a thing, if we would look at it as the 45 words, as the six clauses, the way Madison structured it, we would see that it tells a remarkable story, almost a poem. I call it music, but it's all a series of metaphors designed to urge people to read the story of the First Amendment and to interpret the First Amendment in accordance with the story that it tells. And it's an effort, I think, to rescue it from a kind of rootless First Amendment that has been captured recently in the United States by the powerful.
So let's go through it, and then you can sort of tease it apart for us. Let's actually read out the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the peoples peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. Now, I have to be pretty honest. It sounds less poetic than I think we might imagine. Imagine a poetry to be, because it's a very concise set of words. How do you explain why the very first thing on this list is religion, the protection against and of religion?
Sure. It's poetry. It may be postmodern poetry, the question you ask is exactly the right question. Why does Madison structure it this way? Why do we start the First Amendment with two clauses about religion, establishment and free exercise? Why do we end it with petition? Why is speech right in the middle and just before press? Why is assembly after press? And is there some reason why it's structured as it was? So what I do is I go back to the 18th century when we drafted it. And the 18th century, the idea of religion in the 18th century, especially the way Madison viewed it, was essentially a protection of conscience. It's still a protection of conscience in the modern world. Religion is a kind of relationship that you have with either a supreme being or some extraordinary set of norms by which you've chosen to live your life, by which you try to live in accordance with what you understand to be a conscientious vision of your life. And so no democracy can exist if it doesn't have a citizenry that is free to think, that is free to have a conscience and free to act consistently with that conscience, without the state telling them what they should believe and how they should act. So Madison starts the Bill of Rights. He starts the First Amendment exactly where he has to, with the protection of free thought in the mind of a free citizen.
And after thought, then, comes speech. And we have reduced the First Amendment to mostly be about speech, or it's something that we see, in our day-to-day colloquial conversations as the First Amendment being speech. But speech is the second and not last thing that comes right after the freedom of thought,
as you put it. And if you were setting up, if you were sitting down to write a blueprint for a democracy, you would first say, all right, the first thing I want to make sure is that we have citizens free to think. Then the next thing you would say is, I want a citizen, once the citizen is thinking and an idea pops into the citizen's head, I want the citizen to be able to speak. I want the citizen to be able to articulate that idea to his neighbors. I want the citizen to be able to express the idea as vigorously as he wishes. And so it makes perfect sense that right after freedom of thought comes freedom of speech. Now, as you point out quite correctly, what the current Supreme Court has done is it's taken those 10 words, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech, which is less than a quarter of the whole First Amendment, and has essentially said, that's everything. It does all the work. It eats up the press clause. It eats up the assembly clause. It eats up the petition clause. It even tells us how we decide the religion cases these days. And so I call it the imperial free speech clause that has conquered the rest of the First Amendment. Not only that, they don't even use the whole 10 words. The 10 words are, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. They throw the freedom of out, because the freedom of is a man-made idea. Somebody has to sit down and say what's inside the freedom of and what's outside the freedom of. So instead they read it as saying, Congress shall make no law abridging speech. And then they use that as a very powerful and, as for much of my career, I think an excellent tool to make sure that the government stays out of the business of communication. But that's an essentially rootless idea. Congress shall make no law abridging speech. First of all, it can't be right. You can abridge blackmail. You can abridge threats. You can abridge extortion. So it can't be just because you speak, there's no protection. Someone, some adult in the room, has to sit down and say, what should be inside the freedom of speech and what should be outside the freedom of speech? And my thesis is, the way you answer that question is to say, I understand. Speech is right after thought. It's the articulation that comes right after thought of the idea that the free thought allowed. And it's then no coincidence that the very next thing that Madison puts in there is press. Because I'm going to reach more people on your program today than I ever speak to in my entire life if I spoke only to them. And so Madison realized that what you need in a democracy, if you're going to have these ideas, is a mechanism for mass dissemination. And that's the press. Mm-hmm. And that's why he puts press right after speech. It's exactly where it should be in the blueprint. But the modern Supreme Court says the speech clause does all the work and the press clause is just kind of window dressing. And they've literally read it out of the First Amendment.
And the very next freedom that is listed in the First Amendment is, of course, the freedom of assembly. And people assemble and gather when they know what to assemble and gather over, which they rely on the press for to amplify the voices who are speaking based on their thoughts. Okay, so I've sort of traced that back through this pattern that you point out.
Yeah, if you were setting up a democracy, you would say free thought, then articulation of the thought, then mass dissemination of the thought. And then the next thing you would say is collective action in defense of the thought. So the assembly is the collective action provision. It allows us to group together in support of ideas. And most importantly, it is the only thing in the First Amendment that is where the speech is truly free. You can express yourself by assembling, even if you don't have money, even if you don't have an education. It is the ability by which poor people can make their ideas and needs known in an effective way, using sweat equity and body rhetoric. And the Supreme Court has simply written that part of the First Amendment out of the document. We should never have been able to suppress Occupy Wall Street so quickly, simply because it was a little inconvenient to people to have public spaces being taken up with by people who were urging the needs of poor people. We suppressed it much too quickly and inconsistently with what I believe Madison's idea was, that once an idea is out there, you need to have some protection for collective action in support of it. And then finally, the petition clause. Once you've organized in defense of an idea, the next logical thing to do is to put that idea on the table in the legislature and get them to vote on it. And so it couldn't be organized any other way. It is the perfect story, the half-life of a democratic idea, emerging from the free conscience of a free person, freely articulated, mass disseminated, collectively acted upon, and then presented to the organs of the legislature for final resolution.
And yet,
that's how we should be reading the First Amendment.
And yet today, Bert, we have seen the Supreme Court, particularly the Roberts Supreme Court, use the idea that the First Amendment is about a free market of ideas, but a free market rather than free speech. And we've seen this being turned into a tool of corporate power in a manner that was never intended, perhaps because now money and the influence of money in our politics is protected as free speech. And that seems to be such an utter perversion of the original intent.
That's exactly right. That's really why I wrote the book. I wrote the book. First of all, the book is not just for lawyers. It's not even primarily for lawyers. It's for ordinary citizens who have to recapture their First Amendment. The First Amendment is too important to leave to lawyers. It's too important to leave to judges, and it's too important to leave to rich people. My plea is, tonight, I was so glad that you began the interview by reading the entire First Amendment. Go home. Find the First Amendment, find the Bill of Rights, read it, see the story that it tells you. If you see the way these six ideas hook together, then you'll know that it's telling you a story of a functioning democracy, and you'll know that the campaign finance cases have to be wrong. Because as you point out, what a very narrow majority, five members of the current court, read the Supreme Court as though it is read the First Amendment as though it is just a license to deregulate. They deregulate anything. The right will deregulate anything it can get its hands on. So it loves the First Amendment because it deregulates everything to do with speech. Once you do that, once you take the government entirely out of the regulation process, somebody comes in and does the exercises the power, and it will be the rich and the powerful, the big media companies, the large corporations, very wealthy people seeking influence. They will step in and dominate the speech market if there's no government regulation. Mm-hmm. Now, for liberals, view the First Amendment as what I call an aspirational First Amendment, a First Amendment that hopes to achieve the kind of city on the hill that Madison and the founders wanted. And that's an egalitarian democracy where everybody exercises equal political rights, and where the rich cannot dominate the marketplace of ideas because they own all of the organs of communication.
So, Bert, if there is this very deliberate pattern in the First Amendment, is there a broader pattern to the Bill of Rights in general? For example, why is the Second Amendment, one that we see as protecting the rights of gun owners today?
Good for you. It is that's exactly the right question. Once you get done with thinking about how the wonderful horizontal organization of the six ideas in the First Amendment tells you a story, then the next question is, well, if I look at it vertically, if I look at it 1 through 10, does that tell me a story too? And it does. It tells a remarkable story. The First Amendment is the ideal city on the hill that the founders wanted. The rest, the second through the eighth, the next seven amendments are descriptions by the founders of the dangers to the city on the hill and the creation of institutional protections to prevent it. So the reason the Second Amendment is where it is, the reason it has pride of place is coming right after the first, is that the founders saw military overthrow as the single greatest risk to a democracy. And they were right. If you look at history, the overthrow or subversion of democracy by either the police or the military is the fate of most democracies. And they saw it, and they said, you know how we're going to fix it? We're going to fix it by creating a shadow army of the people, the well-regulated militia, every one of whom is entitled to have a musket. And when we need them to protect the people, the democracy against a military that is trying to subvert it, we will call on the shadow army of the people. Madison's brilliant perception is that where the army or the police don't look just like the people that they are serving, It is a matter of time until they turn on the segment of the population that's left out.
And
you
of course,
you have to Ferguson, Missouri.
Right.
Just look at Ferguson, Missouri. Look at any city in America in which you do not have a significant black presence on the police force, and I will show you a city where a white police force oppresses the black population.
Well,
and that's what the Second Amendment is about.
And that's sadly the topic of another conversation, but I want to thank you so much, Bert, for joining us, and our audience can certainly read your entire book to see the music of Madison and the entire Bill of Rights. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
My guest, Bert Newborn, is the Inez Milholland Professor of Civil Liberties and the founding legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at the New York University Law School. He's also a contributor to The Nation, and we've been discussing his book, Madison's Music, on Reading the First Amendment.